Yes, yes, folks, welcome along once again to the Retro Asylum podcast. Myself, Matt Denaris, taking you through. This is the number, I think it's 17 and a half podcast. I was on the 14 and a half podcast, I think, talking about Team 17. But this time around, something completely different. As you well know, we are the UK's number one retro gaming podcast. Catch us on www.retroasylum.com. You can come there, check out the latest news, views, different podcasts. I'll be going through a few of the podcasts we host and promote on there. Of course, there's a forum as well, and the site's just going to grow and grow, I'm sure, throughout this year. Shout out to Andy, the rest of the site crew who run things nice and proper. So here we go, onwards and upwards. What is this show about? Well, I want you to cast your mind back. Take yourself back. Probably for the majority of us, 20 years, maybe a little bit more for some of the old folk out there. 25 years. Actually, yeah, I'm thinking about 25 years for me, so that's a long time, isn't it? It's much more than half my life ago. And that's when you feel old, is when you start talking about things like that. But I want you to cast your mind back. Be it 15, be it 10, be it 25, be it 40 years ago. If there's anyone out there listening who's that old, then respect to you, my friends. Respect to you. It's the school holidays, it's Easter, it's summer, it's half term. The year of schooling, in my case, particularly boring, wasn't a fan of school. When I look back on it, I wish I'd have made more of having a laugh at school, but cast your mind back to then. You looked forward to the Easter holidays, you looked forward to the summer holidays, and what did those holidays bring? Holidays, not just a holiday off school, but on the odd occasion, your parents, if they're feeling flush, they'd splash out on a nice little holiday for you. Probably a caravan park, maybe pontins, hoe seasons, or buttons. Not sure Haven were around back in those days, but they are now, that's for sure. You're driving down there to the coast. It's going to be a holiday of a lifetime. It always felt like that when you were young. Every holiday was brilliant. But what does a holiday bring? What does a campsite bring? Obvious, arcades. Women, poor, they were not even on your radar come sort of 10 years old, 12 years old. Certainly in our community anyway, is arcades. It's the fact you can touch and feel the holy grail of all computing, the arcade machine. Just the arcade and touching and feeling it, when you think back now, you've got that. I mean, I alluded to this in an earlier podcast, is the bottling up that atmosphere, and that's what you got when you walked into an arcade. You got that atmosphere. It was the rubber of the arcade machine when you got driving games, coin smell, that metallic smell, the musty carpets on the floor that have untold drinks and dog shit traipsed all through it. It's all there. That's all part of the atmosphere. And that's another big part of the, well, like I said, I alluded to this before, atmosphere and everything like that. But you got to this caravan park, you wanted to check out that arcade, see what was in there. It was 1942, and in 1943, Outrun, Operation Wolf, APB, Paperboy. I'm reeling off my classics from those days, all these shoot 'em ups and driving games, Chase HQ, which was great in the arcade, and later on, going Sega Rally. We all had 8-bit machines, Commodore 64, Spectrum, Amstrad, whatever, some of the lesser known ones, MSX, and consoles, NES, Master System. We're all living and breathing those. Some of the more fortunate people in the later days, the sort of late 80s, you have got the Atari ST and Amiga owners who had better arcade ports, but we had, as 8-bit owners, that aspiration to have the graphics like the arcade, the sound like the arcade. Oh my god, that's what we want, that's what we've got to have. So what I want to talk about here is the arcade conversion. Is why should we play in this day and age arcade conversions when you can immerse yourself in that atmosphere, in that, with those sounds, with those graphics, with that gameplay in the original, so easy with MAME these days. And MAME is nearest damn it spot on. Okay, you're always going to have folk, and I'm one of them, who says emulation is not like the real thing. Of course it's not like the real thing, but my god, it's pretty damn good, isn't it? Especially if you've got a decent controller. Why should we play these arcade conversions? Now, I asked the community this on the forum, because in my mind at that particular point in time, I couldn't really think of reasons why you'd want to play an arcade conversion when you've got the original. But some of the responses, and I've been trawling around the internet just to see what other people think. I think I have a rounder understanding now of it, and that's what I'm going to talk about here. So like I say, the arcade was always the holy grail. We were always waiting as kids for that arcade conversion to come along, that review in Crash or Zap or CMVG, whatever magazine was tickling your fancy at that particular time. We waited for it to come along. Reviews were good. You think, God, I've got to have this. You get it, and it's obviously a really good game. In a lot of cases, you cast your mind back to those holidays and think, ooh, it's not really like what I remember. Its graphics were a lot more colourful. Ah, of course, I'm an 8-bit machine. It's not going to be as good. It's not as good a machine, of course. They've got untold custom chips and whatever else. So we thought back in the day in the arcade machines. But you're happy with it. I remember picking up Ivan Iron Man Stewart's Off-Road Racing, and that was a great conversion on the C64. Had I actually seen the original? I think I had, yeah. I'm sure I'd seen it in the arcade, and the Commodore 64 version was good. So I thought at the time, when I play it now, it just feels really clunky. The Amiga and ST got a fantastic conversion of it. And I remember this stat to this day. In one of the magazines, they were doing the interview with the developers of Ivan Iron Man Stewart, and they were showing the statistics between the arcade and the conversions, and I remember graphics amount of sprites in the arcade was 418. Not sure whether that was just sure it wasn't just the truck itself. It could have been the flags as well, which were rocked when you hit them and so forth. So it's 418 in the arcade. Amiga and ST was 416. This must have been Ace magazine, as it's covering so many different formats here. And the Commodore was 80. And I remember sitting there feeling gutted when I read that. Absolutely gutted. But it was a great conversion at the time. It felt really good, played really well. And yeah, like I say now, I'm not so keen on it. So why would I want to go back to that when I can play the arcade version? Why would I even want to play the Amiga version when I've got the arcade version? Even though it is a very, very good, not far off the truth version of Iron Man Stewart. And another thing I'm going to come on to, probably not in this podcast, but another one is are there any arcade conversions that were better than the original that people think? I'm going to talk about one here for sure, but maybe do a whole section on it another time. So the community come back with responses along the lines of it's about nostalgia, and I think that's why we're a community. That's why people like retro gaming. It's all the nostalgia around it. But again, that'll be a reminder on my phone, so wonderful. It's not telling me about any kind of retro gaming or go and play a game now, so I'm going to ignore that wholeheartedly. Lost my trail now. Where the hell was I? Everyone was talking about nostalgia to begin with, and yeah, I can see that. But then again, the arcade is a nostalgic version. Arcade surely re-sparks those memories of when you were at the holiday camp. So why not play them? And then another one got brought up, was around, and I really, really like this one, and now I've heard it, I really respect that view, and I'll find out who said that as well, was the fact of, because they were arcade conversions, and because the machines that they were being written on couldn't necessarily handle the game as well as in the arcade, things had to be tailored for that machine a little bit more. So maybe it was a little bit more difficult, maybe it was a little bit easier, maybe there was slight nuance to the gameplay that wasn't in the arcade version. And when I thought about that, that's a really nice way to look at it, that because these developers were trying to push everything into such a small machine, certainly in the case of the 8-bits, when you're taking a game like, I don't know, Operation Wolf, which incidentally is one of my favourite arcade conversions on the Commodore 64. Operation Wolf was brilliant on that. Having read an interview since with the developer, I respect that even more. Yes, bringing those slightly different elements into the game to make it work on those lower machines must have been definite consideration on every single arcade conversion that was being done. Like I keep on going back to the 8-bit days. 16-bit was probably, certainly when it hit the 90s and you got the Mega Drive, Amiga, later, a little bit later the SNES, they were far more capable. And when the programs were able to push them a little bit further, the arcade conversions were getting more and more like the original. But I really like that view on where it was. So I'd like to give respect to Dirk Dig Dugler for that one. He comes up with a great, great point there is that in this day and age, you can have infinite credits on MAME. You just keep on hammering that 5 key and you can have as many credits as you would have dreamed of when you're in those arcades back when you're about 10 and begging your dad for more pocket money. Please, another 10, another 20p. God knows what the parents of today would have been like if arcades were that prominent now, and the fact that they're a quid a go doesn't bear thinking about. So yeah, that brings us a definite different view on arcade conversions, and I really like that view on it. Another one is, from a technical standpoint, is how the developers could squeeze something so big into something so small. Again, when it got to the 16-bit era, it wasn't quite so relevant, but if you look at Commodore 64 versions of Power Drift and Buggy Boy, two great arcade conversions there. I would still say R-Type on the Commodore 64, and there's a great example there of something that wasn't rated too well at the time, but has its own challenge, because I don't know why some of the enemies were taken out. It didn't play quite like, in terms of the enemy waves, didn't play quite like the original, whereas the Spectrum was far more spot on. Really great conversion on the Spectrum, but the Commodore 64 version felt a little bit like a different game, so it was almost like its own game in its own right, but with R-Type graphics. But squeezing those big arcade games down onto something a lot smaller was always a big challenge for the developers, and it was always good to see how well they come out. Been interrupted once again. I'm going to have to get that. A key factor for me was sound. And if you look at the sound chips that were used in the arcade in those sort of late 80s, early 90s, they weren't as good as some of the sound chips in the home computers. Now, I'm going to go straight towards the Commodore 64 and the SID chip, which is one of the greatest sound chips ever produced in terms of its specification and the sound quality. The SID had phenomenal synthesis abilities for its time, and you've just got to listen to stuff that's being cranked out of it now, and the fact that a synthesizer was built around it, and there is still a very big hobbyist scene around SID synthesis and building hardware devices that take the SID chip into it. The SID, when you look back on it, in a lot of respects was so far superior to some of those arcade games, yet there's something about the FM chips that were used in the arcade games. They weren't solely FM chips, but there was a lot of it in there. But that brings me on to one of the key conversions which I think was actually better than the arcade, and that's Silkworm on the Amiga. And I'm saying that purely because of the sound. A lot of really hard samples were used in that for explosions and great music. The sound really gives such an impact, and in a shoot-em-up game, impact and explosions are really what it needs to show you're kicking the crap out of people and shooting the hell out of stuff. And I don't get that in the arcade. It looks better, yes, it's got parallax scrolling, yes, it's more colourful, yes, but as a game, I personally prefer the Amiga version. The Amiga version was developed by the same guys that ended up doing Swiv as well, which was unofficial, we should put that in air quotes there, unofficial follow-up to Silkworm. So that's one conversion I believe was better. I think the whole work some conversions better than the arcade original is worthy of its own podcast, so I'm not going to go into that too much just here. But yeah, I could ramble and bumble on about this for a long, long time. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. Like anything, it's everyone's opinion, isn't it? My opinion is, in the majority of cases, I'd rather boot up MAME and have a go on that and limit myself on credits. Yes, you can pummel in those though the coins like you would have loved to in the arcade back in the day, but I like to limit myself and not cheat essentially by doing that. So you might only get one life or three lives, and then you can continue, simple as that. I prefer chucking MAME on, putting a ROM into that and playing that than I would a lot of arcade conversions, certainly in the 8-bit days. I don't see, in this day and age, there's a huge amount of value in playing a lot of the 8-bit arcade conversions. Of course, there's exceptions. I'll probably be berated for this, but yeah, there's exceptions. Like I said earlier, R-Type on the Spectrum, absolutely fantastic, and a cracking conversion, well worthy of playing in its own right. But in general, generally they were just inferior versions of them. But you've got to give absolute respect to developers. They were all under time frame, deadline problems, get the game finished in 3 months, 3 weeks, whatever, and they had to squeeze this massive game down into a small computer, probably in a lot of cases, but not with access to the original machine, or they might have had to go onto their local arcade to play it. No original source code, no original graphics, etc., etc. So the job they did was fantastic, and looking back on it, yeah, what a great job they've done. And it's very interesting to look back on those conversions now, but I don't think, like I said, for me, I don't want to go back and play those in particular, bar the odd exception. So that definitely wraps up the little discussion there on arcade conversions. You're listening to the Retro Asylum podcast, www.retroasylum.com. This is the number 17 and a half podcast, and I'm Matt Denaris. I've got a second subject here. This is around graphics, the graphics that date, because graphically, going back to the arcade thing as well, when you look at the arcade conversions, the graphics are dated further than the actual arcade in a lot of cases. And that's very similar to what I'm about to talk about here. Now, I know more than anyone, or as much as anyone, that graphics don't make the game at all. They're not the make or break part of a game, but they add so much to the game's presence, the feel, and generally the overall experience. I don't think you could rule out graphics as being... Oh, don't worry, it's not about graphics, it's about the gameplay, which is what we used to say a lot in the old days. I don't think that's the case. It's part of the whole experience. We all need sound and graphics. We need that sort of aural and the visceral experience that sound and the graphics, along with the gameplay, makes. And, you know, let's face it, Mario, without his cutesy graphics, wouldn't have been... Mario, it wouldn't have been as enchanting. Let's take Cannon Fodder as an example. Without his cartoon gore and his sort of a comedy gore, it wouldn't have drawn you into its personality. So yes, gameplay absolutely rules the roost, but graphics play a massive part into it. And this feeds somewhat into the retro debate of what is retro, when what do you deem as retro? And I think graphics is a key part of that, because would you deem 3D based platforms retro? People would say the PlayStation 1 is retro, the Saturn is retro. I'm inclined to agree, totally. And obviously 3D was being done on the platforms before that. But coming on to the graphics, back to that whole gameplay, graphics, sound thing. Without the graphics, surely the gameplay would still exist. Is that right? Is that wrong? I don't know. Because surely gameplay is gameplay, but you need those graphics there. And I think what makes me think about this whole graphics thing more is the very early games, the early 8-bit games and stuff that may predate that as well. ZX81 games, early Spectrum games, where everything was primitive, not just the graphics or the gameplay, but the graphics are very primitive. And I just can't believe that people would look back now and want to play a game on a ZX81 if it held no nostalgic value for you, because we're all finding new retro games all the time to play, new old games, that's what I like to call them, new old games all the time. But would you really want to find a new old ZX81 game or a Spectrum game that was that primitive as like the early Spectrum games? If you look at the homebrew stuff coming out now on the Spectrum, Commodore 64, it's stuff that's pushing the boundaries a little bit further. So they still look quite good, in a lot of cases look very, very good, and really are sort of a great advert for what the Spectrum and Commodore and all these old machines could do. I just don't think I'd want to go and play an old ZX81 game if one that was developed at the time. It just would look and feel horrible to me. This is, again, my personal opinion. Coming on to the Spectrum, as it progressed and things started picking up, the Spectrum had the resolution, the screen resolution to go with it. The graphics were always very detailed. Let's look at a Chase HQ as another arcade conversion. The graphics are really, really nice, that really detailed. Wet Le Mans. I've chosen two driving games there just off the top of my head. Really good graphically there. The Commodore 64 had the sound more than the graphics. The graphics were didn't have quite the resolution of the Spectrum in its standard resolution mode. It had the sound, and that's for sure, and that's another debate right there. But when you get to the 16-bit machines, I think they've dated as far as they can go, if that makes sense. A lot of 2D games, if you look at just the 2D games on it, they're not really dating anymore. They've done all the dating they can, so they still look good now, in my opinion. Once you hit that crossover from 8-bit to 16-bit, mid-range Amiga games, games from 91, 92, Mega Drive games, SNES games, Neo Geo games. They're all, Neo Geo could be argued to be arcade, of course, but they're all sort of stuff that really looks great nowadays. SNES, just look at Super Mario World, one of the first games on it. Don't know whether it was the first game, or I'm not that hot on my SNES stuff, but it still looks fantastic today. It still looks like you could release it today as a cheaper game, not as an indie game, but as one of these cheaper on a PSN, Xbox Live type thing, and it'd go down really well because it still looks good. And I think with 2D, certainly in that era, it's done all the dating it can do. It will look good now until the day we pop our clogs and end up 6 feet under the ground. Then you come on to, so let's negate the old 8-bit, which I think everyone was in agreement, surely, that it looks dated and just looks really, really primitive now, is early 3D games that were trying to be, I suppose you could call it photorealistic, they were just trying to be realistic. 3D games on the Amiga, on the Mega Drive and SNES, even on the Commodore 64, and that, they were polygons. They were basic polygons. They, in some cases, take Formula One Grand Prix on the Amiga, they were trying to look like the real thing, but they were so far from it, your brain wasn't really clicking into the realism aspect there. But then you start stepping into PlayStation 1 and Saturn, and they were using texture mapping and light shading and so forth on the polygons, and that is when I think you can look back now and go, God, that looks really dated compared to the 3D graphics as now, which I still don't think are that perfect. They're getting so close, but there's still a massive gap between realism and gaming that your brain doesn't see it quite as real, if that makes any sense at all. But PlayStation 1 and Saturn and those early 3D games, you look at them now, the resolution I think is what gives it. There's a lot of jaggies there, there's no smoothing, no anti-aliasing. The texture mapping is pretty crude, so any of the graphics, any of the mappings on there look really blocky again. And I think they look really, really dated. It looked great at the time. When the PlayStation 1 came out, you had... you could use Wipeout as a good example of something that doesn't look quite so dated because it's not trying to be like something. I can't walk outside and get into my spacecraft now that looks a bit like Wipeout. Whereas when you get Destruction Derby or Ridge Racer, I could walk outside and get in my Honda NSX or my crappy old Datsun and drive around and smash into a few things. And when they were trying to look like the real thing, I think that's where it fell down more than anything. Of course, there were some great 2D games on the PlayStation 1 and Saturn. A lot of great, great shooters on the Saturn, which, again, it's the 2D argument. They look great nowadays. So, basically, there is no argument on that one. But I think it's the 3D, really, that looks dated and looks like it's had its day. You wouldn't really get a huge amount of enjoyment from going back and playing it now because of how well it's advanced nowadays. But the 2D stuff, I think you can go back and play a lot of the 2D games and still not feel like you're being shortchanged almost. Until I could use my arcade argument earlier on as being a point in question that you might not want to go back to it and play those games. But still, that's my slant on that. But I think a great exception to this rule, because it's not a rule, of course, but a great exception to this opinion, as there is always exceptions, is vector graphics, which they look stylish to this day. And there's obviously been things like Geometry Wars and Geometry Wars 2, and there's a whole little breed of those type of games which have taken vector graphics and made them really trendy again and really stylish and bring them up to date brilliantly. But you look at old vector graphic games, old Vectrex games. I have played a Vectrex once at a retro gaming fair, and it's a fantastic looking machine. It really is something very, very different. They don't look so dated because there's something about that 2D wireframe that's never tried to really replicate a real life thing, because nothing in the real world is a vector wireframe. It'd be pretty strange if it was, but quite funky actually. And depends how. I mean, if you're on a specific type of drug, it might look like that. But it's not like, I go back to that 3D thing where they were trying to copy real life things, and it just didn't work for me. Really didn't work. Vector graphics, you weren't really copying anything. I'll use Star Wars in the arcade as a prime example of a really, really good vector game. It still looks brilliant to this day. Everything from the scores and your lives and the graphical gameplay is all done in Vector, and that looks brilliant. And there's some great Vector games that come out on the home computers. One that stands out is Darkstar on the Spectrum, which was very similar to certain aspects of the Star Wars game. It's Vector. It still looks stylish today. Pop onto YouTube, have a look at Darkstar on the Spectrum, and it still looks pretty decent today. It looks, like I just said, very, very stylish. I think Vector graphics are kind of excluded from this conversation because they really look great to this day. And if you look at why Vector graphics become favourable, from what I read and hear, is that programmers found a great way of being able to zoom in and rotate the graphics easier and so forth. I don't know on the technicalities behind that, but I can see the reasoning behind it, because when you're using a 3D type shape, you can rotate it a lot easier than a 2D type bitmap sprite. Some more great examples, I'll give one great example of a more modern day Vector game, and that was Rez on the Dreamcast, which came out, God, I say modern, but that's 11 years ago nearly now, I think that came out. Fantastic, and I think you can get it on Xbox Live and probably the PSN network as well. That's a great example of Vector done for the modern day. Such a stylish game anyway, but those Vector graphics really just look so stylized. From memory, I believe it starts turning into polygons later on, those vectors start filling out, but what a great game and what a great way to use the graphics. And I think you'll look back on that in 20 years time and that game will still look stylish, whereas if you go back to the PS1 games from 15, 16, 17 years ago, they don't look so good when they're 3D and trying to be realistic. But I don't know, this conversation could go on a lot longer, but I'm going to start wrapping it up now because I've done almost half an hour of this podcast, so I'm going to give a few shout-outs and so forth. Like I said, you're listening to the Retro Asylum podcast, and for those iTunes listeners who don't know about the website, get down there, www.retroasylum.com. You can come down there, it's a great little community, lovely little forum that's going on there. Also, the site likes to promote other podcasts, UK podcasts out there doing the same kind of thing, retro. Don't forget, you've got the Retro Resistance podcast, which is hosted by Tony and Malk there from the forum. Was it XBecStar and Malk 1976? That's a great little podcast there, and they've now moved it over to iTunes as well as YouTube. I'm not too sure, but great podcast. Game of Dads podcast, really enjoying that one. Nice little chemistry going on with the reviewers and hosts there. One of the community podcasts, Odd Pod, just released a new one called Odd Bit, which is about Dreamcast. Looking forward to hearing that. Love the Dreamcast bits. And there's one other podcast, which I completely forget the name of now, Arcade and Retro podcast at arcadeandretro.com. Check that one out. I'd also personally like to give a shout to the Retro Gaming Roundup podcast, which is a mammoth 6-hour odd podcast on a monthly basis. Really technical, really in-depth, but really informative and funny at the same time. So finally, just to say, get yourself over to the forum on retroasylum.com. Join yourself up, join in the lively chat on there. We'll welcome you aboard with open arms. I'm absolutely sure of that. You've been listening to Matt Denaris. I'm out of here. Speak to you soon. Bye.